All right, we're going to start with Representative Murphy's bill, which is House File 3333. And we're waiting on one more member, so we're not going to move the bill yet, but we can start the testimony. I never got this. Representative Walker.
Diane. Representative Walker.
Or some Walker.
Huh?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Since we're not ready to move my amendment, I'm going to begin with my testimony, and we'll take action on the bill when we're completed. I'd like to talk with you today about House File 3333, which is a cancer risk reduction bill. This session, we have focused our attention on prevention and health. This legislation falls under that category by reducing the risk of cancer. House File 3333 would apply to apply the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's more protective risk assessment factor to known carcinogens as established by the U.S. EPA, U.S. National Toxicology Program, or the International Agency for Research on Cancer. This factor is used by the state risk managers in their efforts to predict risk and prevent harm. The bill has been drawn to reflect settled science. The bill applies established EPA policies and includes only those human carcinogens shown proven to cause cancer. I hope to earn your support, and with that, I'd like to turn your attention to our testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Samuel Yaman, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I did have some handouts here for committee members. If I could ask one of the staff to please distribute those. Thank you. As Representative Murphy mentioned, the purpose of this legislation would be to increase protections from carcinogenic substances in the environment. To reiterate, this would require the Department of Health to apply a more protective risk level when using standardized quantitative methods to assess population risks from carcinogens. And as Representative Murphy also stated, this would mean that Minnesota would join the other states who are already applying the more protective end of the U.S. EPA's recommended range. So still within that EPA recommended range, just moving to a more protective position within that range. As Representative Murphy also mentioned, there are hundreds of substances listed by U.S. federal agencies such as EPA and our National Toxicology Program, and by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is a branch of the World Health Organization. So these chemicals that are listed as known human carcinogens or probable human carcinogens represent decades of study and analysis, mountains of scientific evidence, and so these aren't cutting-edge chemicals or decisions. These are chemicals that have been shown in repeated studies to cause cancer. Not all of these substances are present here in Minnesota, but dozens of them are found here in significant quantities in the environment, and that's been documented by the monitoring programs conducted by state agencies. So the bill would apply a core public health principle of preventing disease by reducing the public's exposure to chemicals that have been shown to cause cancer. And the causes of most individual cases of cancer are generally unknown. But if even a small percentage of cases are related to environmental or occupational chemical exposures, the benefits of increased protections would be huge. So even if that's 5, 10, 15% of cancers are related to these, that's still a huge saving in human lives and suffering. Also economically. Cancer is now the leading cause of death in Minnesota, and there are 20,000 new cases each year in our state. The treatment costs cost the U.S. economy over $70 billion per year, and for individuals, the out-of-pocket costs to patients average around $20,000 during the first year after diagnosis. Looking at specific types of cancer, rates of lung cancer are relatively low in Minnesota. This would seem to reflect the fact that Minnesotans don't smoke cigarettes very much compared to other states. But what about other types of cancer, where the causes are not always as clear as tobacco-related lung cancer? Compared to other states, Minnesota has one of the highest rates of prostate cancer, and we also have a very high rate of breast cancer. Our rates are also high for leukemia, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, uterine cancer, and some of the others. We're often told that the primary risk factors for cancer are smoking, diet and obesity, and other personal lifestyle factors such as drinking, alcohol, or lack of exercise. But Centers for Disease Control surveys report that Minnesotans are living healthier than average compared to other states for these personal lifestyle factors. In other words, people who live healthy are still getting cancer, and even very young children are. Well, of course, this doesn't mean that one shouldn't live a healthy lifestyle or that healthy lifestyle practices aren't important. Nor does it imply that environmental carcinogens are the number one cause of cancer. What these facts do indicate is that we shouldn't ignore preventable causes of cancer, whether it's some aspect of our lifestyle or the documented presence of dozens of chemical carcinogens in Minnesota's air, water, and soil. In conclusion, I would just mention that scientific studies have linked chemical exposures to nearly 40 types of cancer, and knowing that these same chemicals are present in large amounts in our environment here in Minnesota, a sound public health strategy would be to minimize the public's exposure to those carcinogens. Excuse me. This legislation represents one step towards that public health goal. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Representative Murphy, we have a quorum now, so I'm going to officially bring the meeting to order. And Representative Murphy will move House File 3333 be recommended to pass to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And you also have a DE1 amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to put that on?
I move the DE1 amendment.
Okay, just to put in the form the author would like it, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Susan Nordby, and I live in Minneapolis. I come to speak with you today as an eight-year cancer survivor. It isn't easy for me to come before you today, not because I'm afraid of public speaking, but rather because I'm a cancer survivor, one of the lucky ones. And I would prefer to dwell on the gratitude I feel for still being alive. However, I feel compelled to tell you of my experience with cancer so that I might illustrate in human terms the urgent need and opportunity before you to vote for this bill and protect people from exposure to carcinogens. At the age of 42, and again 1 year later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Although women now have a 1 in 8 chance of being diagnosed with breast cancer during their lifetime, 42 is considered a young age for diagnosis. I was shocked. My family history did not include breast cancer, as is the case in 90% of women who get breast cancer. I wasn't a smoker, didn't drink alcohol, was not overweight, ran 3 miles a day, and I ate my fruits and vegetables. With a graduate degree in public health from UCLA and being a registered dietitian, I knew how to practice healthy behaviors. Still, I got cancer, as do many people with no family history or negative lifestyle factors. Significantly, I did have repeated environmental exposures to the carcinogen DDT during my pre-adolescent years, and mounting scientific evidence indicates that girls exposed to DDT during childhood are at increased risk for developing breast cancer later in their lives. Of course, DDT was outlawed in this country in 1972, but there are still many known or suspected carcinogens licensed for use to with humans, including vulnerable fetuses and young children, are being exposed. While I will probably never know for certain if environmental exposures were what set me up for developing cancer, I can't help but dwell on one thought. Wouldn't it be better to prevent rather than treat cancer? What if my cancer could have been prevented? At the time I was diagnosed with cancer, I was parenting my grade school-aged son, And I was caring for parents who suffered from Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. What if my young son, my parents, and my other loved ones wouldn't have had to suffer as they did, watching me lose my breath, lose my hair, and vomit for days at a time? What if they didn't have to be terrified that they would lose someone so important in their lives, the person they loved and counted on to take care of their emotional, physical, financial, academic, and legal needs? What if I hadn't needed to repeatedly get so sick from chemo that I couldn't eat anything for days at a time? What if I didn't have neuropathy from chemo and numb areas on my feet now? What if I didn't need to go to my appointment with my surgeon next week to discuss the possibility of removing my reconstructive breast implants that a year ago got infected and are now causing me significant pain and discomfort? What if I didn't now have to pay $520 a year for Fosamax, medication to prevent further bone loss that was initially caused by chemo that destroyed my ovaries and suddenly slammed me into menopause prematurely? What if I didn't have to pay $675 a year for Letrozole, a drug that reduces my risk of a cancer recurrence but increases my risk for heart attack and stroke, contributes further to my bone loss, and causes me to suffer from significant joint pain and swelling? What if the costs of the multiple surgeries, chemotherapy, radiation, ongoing drug treatments, and indefinite oncologist checkups didn't need to be paid or contribute to the spiraling costs of health care and insurance premiums? What if I didn't have to live with the possibility of a cancer recurrence and premature death? What if those who did die of cancer could have never gotten cancer in the first place? Now multiply my case by many times and think of the impact prevention could make on lives, on loved ones, on healthcare costs. I hope I've helped you to see the obvious and urgent need to support reducing risks of exposure to carcinogens. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and member of the committee, my name is Julia Earl, and I'm the director of Preventing Harm Minnesota, a children's environmental health program of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 3333, the Cancer Risk Reduction Bill. Preventing Harm Minnesota's mission is to work together for healthy families by protecting children from toxic threats in the food they eat, water they drink, air they breathe, and products they use. As such, we support this measure because it would reduce exposure levels of known and probable carcinogens for all members of our society and would be particularly protective of children. Preventing Harm Minnesota is concerned about children because they are extremely vulnerable to toxic exposures. This unique vulnerability is discussed in the International Journal of Occupational Medicine and Environmental Health in a 2004 article written by Dr. Philip Landrigan. Dr. Landrigan states, children are highly vulnerable to chemical toxins. They have disproportionately heavy exposures to environmental toxicants. Pound for pound of body weight, children drink more water, eat more food, and breathe more air than adults. Children in the first 6 months of life drink seven times as much water as the average American adult. 1 to 5 year old children eat 3 to 4 times more food. The air intake of a resting infant is twice that of an adult. The implication of these findings for health is that children will have substantially heavier exposures than adults to any toxicants that are present in water, food, or air. In addition to this, children have more hand-to-mouth behavior, thereby getting more toxins in their bodies. They play closer to the ground where many of these exposures occur. They undergo rapid growth and development, and these developmental processes are easily disrupted, and they have more years of future life to live, thereby having more time for chronic diseases to develop. Dr. Landrigan further states, quote, carcinogenic and toxic exposures sustained early in life, including prenatal exposures, appear more likely to lead to disease than similar exposures encountered later, unquote. Given the special conditions of children, this legislation makes particularly good sense. We don't separate our air, water, and food between adult and child populations, so the harmful impact of carcinogens is amplified among children. While this legislation will help to protect everyone by reducing their exposures, we need to be particularly mindful of children. It's imperative to do the best job we can today by enacting prudent policies such as the Cancer Risk Reduction Bill to protect them now and in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members, for the witnesses? Representative Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, I've heard testimony that this is going to stop exposures to carcinogens. That doesn't seem to be what the bill says. Could you tell me what the next step is? If you get this enacted, what's the next step?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, I don't have a next step following the passage of this bill.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. This one goes for one of your witnesses. I think it's Dr. Yeaman, or?
Yeah, just Mr.
Mr., okay. You refer to carcinogens, and there are so many things that have carcinogenic impact, including cell phones, for instance. The one that, and I don't know, maybe I'm mixing terms, you said environmental carcinogens, and we talk about air, water, or soil. The sun is probably the greatest one, unless I've misdefined it, if that's a word. And you said sound public policy is to limit public exposure. Using the sun as an example, how would this bill, how would the Commissioner of Health assess the sun's carcinogenic impact, and what do you think is going to be the result?
Mr. Yeaman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this legislation would only apply to substances that are listed as chemical carcinogens by federal agencies. So that would leave out a lot of different types of carcinogens, including UV exposure that you described in your example, smoking, and then a lot of things that are cell phones would not be included. This is just chemical substances that have been studied for decades and listed by federal agencies. So one, if you think of it as sort of like a pie of cancer causation, this is one slice of the pie. We think it's important, but it's certainly not everything.
Mr. Chair,
remember.
Well, I appreciate that, sir, but cancer is not a pie. It's more like a stew. And UV rays and all kinds of chemicals, I don't know of anyone who has figured out how to separate out what impacts the human person more than the other. And similarly, everybody's genetics are different, so who is more prone to the disease versus somebody who may not be, I don't think that's known either. I think and this is a policy committee. I assume it's going to a finance committee.
It's going to environment next.
Okay, well, yeah. I have some concerns. I appreciate what you're doing. You know that, Representative Murphy, but I think this is much too broad in the current form.
Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask, first of all, Mr. Clarification, you said environment policy or environment finance?
Policy.
Environment policy. Do you know where it goes after that?
No.
Okay. my question, first of all, as you all know, I'm very much supportive of this issue of trying to protect people from exposure. I was chief author on the biomonitoring health tracking bill last year that was passed and signed into law. It did strike me when seeing this, though, that I am concerned that we don't have, that we need additional types of information to ultimately decide what to do with this beef. It's my understanding that, first of all, changing the standard would move the decimal point on things like health risk limits for water from, for example, 7 to 0.7. And having dealt with a CFC issue, which is not listed as a carcinogen, hypothetically speaking, that can change whether or not the PCA has to provide alternative water sources or filters, whether people are liable for doing various things in terms of remediating the water, things like that. So my concern I'm raising when I ask the panel about is, or the health department if they're here, whether or not anyone has yet determined what the costs are going to, or potential costs might be to various stakeholder groups, including government, of implementation across the list of carcinogens that we're dealing with.
If any of the testifiers have any answer, if we can talk to the health department.
I do, Mr. Chair, if that's appropriate.
Sure,
I know that
please.
The representative was. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just briefly, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, there would be costs, some limited costs if there is a enterprise or an individual that was not controlling some of these carcinogens that would be regulated. Purpose of the bill really, at its core, it considers that, you know, we're, as a society, we tell people if you want to avoid cancer, and then avoid too much sun, avoid tobacco, exercise a lot, and watch your personal lifestyle. Our thinking is that we also want to be able to tell people we're doing our best as a society to do our part, being here on the regulatory and legislative side of things. We're doing our best to protect you from all those other things that are floating around out there. Mm-hmm. As an individual, I can choose to restrict my tobacco use and things like this. I can't walk outside and restrict my intake of benzene, mm-hmm. Hexavalent chromium, mm-hmm. and 50 other things that are in the environment. Or you mentioned drinking water. If there were carcinogens in the drinking water, as an individual, it's hard to do that. That's why, as a society, we're hoping to, on this one limited aspect of the whole cancer picture, be able to give people a good answer. Would there be cost? Possibly. I think in terms of permitting some industries that do happen to release a lot of these, I think there could be cost to some of this. I would just ask you to weigh that with some of the costs. If an individual gets cancer, they're looking at $20,000 plus per year of out-of-pocket costs, mm-hmm. to say nothing of the cost of the healthcare system and the rest of society. So mm-hmm. I'll turn that over to Mr. Stein.
Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Langstein. I'm the Director for Environmental Health at the Department of Health. Representative Bunn's question was the costs associated with implementing remedies essentially to address any lowered health risks. Health risk limits or health-based values that might result from a changing in the values. And no, we have not analyzed the costs associated with that, but I agree with what Mr. Yaman said, there'd be costs. And we have not yet analyzed what those might be in a specific situation. Would comment that the PFCs are non-carcinogenic compounds. You made reference to that, and I just wanted to clarify that.
I mentioned they were non-carcinogenic.
Okay, thank you.
So, and just to clarify, so today, Minnesota, for every carcinogen, uses the one in 100,000 standard.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. Do we have a fiscal note on this? What is it going to cost the department, the Pollution Control Agency, the Minnesota Department of Health, mm-hmm. to develop a new, you're going to have to pull through an absolute ton of stuff that you're going to have to regulate and set up new standards for and measure again. That, and then I have a couple other questions.
I think we already regulate all these things, but this will go to the Finance Committee if there's a fiscal note for Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, we have not done a fiscal note. We currently evaluate health risks for carcinogens, so this is not a new endeavor for the Department of Health, so we would not expect our costs associated with developing the health risk limits to change dramatically.
Representative
Trump. Mr.
Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is along the lines of what Representative Bunn was raising. To be responsible in doing something this sweeping, first of all, I would point out you've got United States Environmental Protection Agency, United States Department of Health and Human Services, National Toxicology Program, World Health Program, and International Agency for Research on Cancer. This is something that should be done on the national level, frankly. I mean, to set Minnesota apart could have a detrimental effect on our economy, but has anybody done an analysis on how this would impact all the various things to which this applies? Are we talking about outlawing cars? Not that I'm a big fan of smoking myself, but outlawing it might be part of this too. I mean, what sort of impact is this going to have on our economy and our businesses, and is it practical?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, I'll answer that, and it's kind of a two-part question. In terms of addressing this at the national level, the Environmental Protection Agency is the agency that addresses this. And the way that they work on this type of issue is they provide scientific guidance, and then state agencies in each state carry it out. So what EPA does in the case of these carcinogens is provide a range where each carcinogen has to be regulated at no higher than one excess cancer case per 10,000 risk, down to one per 1 million. So they provide a range, states pick what they do. What we're suggesting is that Minnesota join states that are at the more protective end of that range. And to the second part of your question, there's at least seven that I've been able to verify that are using this more protective level. There's probably a few more, but seven that I've verified. There's no evidence that there's any adverse economic impacts. These are states like California, New York, Massachusetts, with big economies, all sorts of industries. So there's no observed impact on the economies.
Mr. Chair, if I may, one follow-up. Are any of these seven states that you've identified neighboring states to Minnesota?
Mr. Gaiman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the closest one that I know of geographically is Illinois. It doesn't share a border with us, but probably the most akin to us geographically.
Just one final comment. With the tax climate, a business tax climate in the state already ranked 42nd out of 50, and we don't have any neighboring states that have implemented this standard, and we've already heard testimony that suggests this is going to cost more. We don't know how much more, but it's going to cost more to industry and others. Why do we want to add this additional cost, and perhaps a very extreme cost on the backs of businesses in this area, and put ourselves at a further disadvantage? I get the whole taking care of our environment piece, and I want to do well by that too, but we also need to apply a little common sense here.
I'm going to go to Representative Bond.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two comments. First of all, on the responding to President Gottwald on the issue of the tax climate of our state, the governor mentioned that issue in his opening remarks the first night of session to the chamber, and it's been repeated a couple times by people. And that particular study, which I have looked at and had critiqued, only took in one barometer of what creates a good business climate in states. And an alternative approach that takes in a whole range of issues, including the quality of our labor force, the quality of life in Minnesota, and a whole range of issues, the economic climate, Forbes magazine rates us 14th in the nation in terms of our business climate, with quality of life being third in the nation, one of the key factors in raising us up. And I would think the environmental public health situation is one of those things that actually contributes to our quality of life and gives us these kinds of rankings. So I just want to put that out there. But going back to the main theme of what we're talking about, the issue of the cost, I'd like to ask Director Frank Stein a question. In an earlier conversation, you mentioned when I was bringing up the list of carcinogens that we're dealing with, that in fact this bill is focusing on your role as the Department of Health, asking you to use the more safe risk standard in your calculations. But you indicated that most of the carcinogens were not under your purview. They were actually under Ag and MPCA to make the final determination as to what the standards would be, that you would be providing them information, could very possibly provide them a range, like EPA does to you oftentimes, and that, in fact, those agencies would be making the final decision. If you could comment on that and say if I'm portraying it correctly at all.
Representative Bunn, yes, there are three agencies principally involved in implementing the advice on using the health risk information that we developed. It would be the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the Minnesota Department of Health in our drinking water and well management program. Mm-hmm. I need to get back to you with the details of the carcinogens in terms of how they break down between air, water, and soil, and so forth. I need to verify that information. But it is true that the agencies collectively are the ones who then respond to implementing the regulatory side of, okay, so we have a health some health information upon which we guide the actions of or make recommendations to other agencies. Then those agencies take that information and act on it using it as a regulatory for regulatory purposes. Mm-hmm. That may be they may choose to use more information besides the health-based information. They may look at economic impacts. They may look at other factors that guide them in arriving at a regulatory standard, and that is part of the process that every regulatory agency that receives our health-based advice uses, including our own.
Thank you.
Representative Shumpert.
Well, my comment was going to be quite similar to Representative Bunn's in that I didn't think we should hold health hostage to a really serious argument about business climate. But I'm a little confused, Mr. Stein, about this now and your role in it. It seems to me that if this passes, it sets 1 in a million as the absolute standard for rulemaking by your agency and other agencies, doesn't it? And won't that of necessity create uniformity in the state of Minnesota about exposure to a lot of different substances? Or am I wrong? Or am I not understanding that correctly?
Chair, Representative Shumpert, you're correct. It will set for the department the level that we would use in our algorithm as 10 to the minus 6. And other agencies, the effect on them, I haven't analyzed completely, although Subdivision 3 in Section 1 does address the Pollution Control Agency. We would use the 10 to the minus 6 level in our health risk limit establishment for groundwater, for example. We would use it in our advice on air values that we consult with the Pollution Control Agency on, and other risk information that we calculate for the Department of Agriculture.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stein, and as I recall, I've looked at that formula a few times, and it's pretty complicated, so it's only going to be a part of that formulation, isn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Shumpert, that's correct. We currently use 10 to the minus 5th in our groundwater health risk limit, for example. This would set it at 10 to the minus 6th.
Okay, and there are other factors that go into that equation for...
Mr. Chair, Representative Shumpert, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, I may not have a question depending on how, if you clarify for me the carcinogen and whether radon, a naturally occurring gas, is considered a carcinogen.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, radon is listed as a carcinogen by these agencies.
Okay, then my question would be, new home construction is now covered under the state of Minnesota law, or at least when it gets out of rulemaking here, hopefully any day. But I guess I was wondering, it's very specific to new homes, and there are other buildings that are being built, and I'm wondering, when you talk about permits and licenses, if that would apply to buildings now being built that may not fall under that recent law, or what does permit and license refer to?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the federal standard for radon would supersede state guidance.
Mr. Chair.
So this would not affect that.
And there really isn't a federal law that regulates buildings, and so does that mean yours would not apply to radon?
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct. To the extent of my knowledge, there's not a federal law that says you have to act. There is federal guidance on radon, as you observed, and you're allowed to choose to remediate or do whatever you want in your home or building. This would not affect that either way.
Future legislation. Thank you.
President Bell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I've heard it described as a spurious argument, but I would say it's very germane to this entire issue. The impact on the business community is untold here. We don't know what this new measure would require of businesses in our state. And before we do something like this and tie ourselves to World Health Organization or international agencies, because that's what we're doing in this legislation, members, we're tying the determination of a probable human carcinogen or even likely human carcinogen
It only has to appear on the list for any one of these agencies, including the World Health Organization or the International Agency for Research on Cancer. So we are tying state regulation to these other bodies. When they throw something on the list, we have to comply with this. The cost impact is untold. And while Representative Bond has cited a more global measure that Forbes has used, the tax climate in the state, and I can tell you from working years in economic development, is very important to whether or not businesses choose to come here or choose to expand here or go somewhere else. And regulatory environment is another piece of that. And this is a rather dramatic increase in regulation on some of these substances. I would suggest before we move to doing something like this, we ought to understand real clearly what the economic impacts are as well as the health impacts.
Mr. Murphy.
Yeah, I just want to respond. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We tried to draw this bill narrowly and concretely, and that is why we make reference to the national organizations, so we can define clearly what are known carcinogens by these three organizations, which are recognized across the country and by state governments as those with processes that are recognized for delineating what is a substance known to cause cancer. So in including these, we're not trying to broaden the scope of the bill. Instead, we were trying to narrow the scope of the bill and to make clear for policymakers what was being considered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, but again, we're not talking just about known, we're talking about probable, we're talking about likely, and we're not limiting it just to national organizations. The way the language is currently written, it says by at least one. So any one of these organizations, including international agencies, could define something as not even certainly, but probably or likely a carcinogen, and it would have to fall under these regulations for the state of Minnesota. Now, again, I respect the effort to try to clean up our environment and give us a healthier place to live. I get that. But when we're going to do something as broad and sweeping as this, it immediately raises a red flag for me and says, this sounds like federal legislation, first of all. And number two, it suggests that with such broad and sweeping legislation that we ought to check out the economic impacts to our state before we do it. Otherwise, there is a chance we'd be putting ourselves at a disadvantage to the rest of the country, which again argues for federal level legislation for this, not state level. And I've heard the argument that states lead the way, that, you know, states are often the first ones to kind of push the federal government to do things, but we can't even confirm for sure whether it's seven or more states that have this, and the closest state is Illinois. I'd like to know more about the impacts of this kind of legislation and would prefer to see it done federally before I can vote in favor of this. I may vote for this and suddenly find out I just put one of my constituents out of business. Nobody here, I think, can tell me whether or not that's going to happen as a result of this legislation.
And we're going to move on here, members. This is going to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, which will address a lot of those issues. I think the issue before the Health Committee is whether this actually is something that will be a proper and good public health initiative and will improve the health of Minnesotans. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the issues that were raised will be dealt with in the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and the Finance Committee after that if it needs to go there. So, is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, then Representative Murphy will renew her motion that House Bill 3333 be recommended to pass as amended to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. All in favor of that motion say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Dietrich. Representative Dietrich, I will move that House file. Well, actually, Representative Rude, do you want to move House File 3721 be recommended to pass and refer to the Commerce Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to let you know, I have plans for today. Representative Mullen, myself, are going to present the bill, House File 3721. And then we have two testifiers in favor of the bill, and I am sure that there are a couple of testifiers in opposition of the bill. So I will go ahead and get started. Members, in the 2005 session, we passed a dramatic health care reform package that would give small employers that have 50 employees or less product flexibility and cost reduction.
Yes.
The bill passed with strong bipartisan support, and the only problem with that bill currently is that the insurance companies right now are not offering or marketing the new plan. House File 3721 is not a new law. It simply requires all the insurers with 10% or more of the marketplace to, and of course that would be the big three, Blue Cross, Health Partners, and Medica, to offer the new plan to each small business upon the sale or renewal of a policy. Obviously, those of you who know me, I'm not real big on mandates, but unless we do this, in my opinion, these new plans will never be offered, and providing affordable health care for small businesses will continue to be put off. In 2005, we made a case for this bill, the flexible benefits for small businesses, and I'm not going to remake that whole case. I just want to bring up one startling fact in my own opinion, and that is that most of the problem with the working uninsured is found with companies of 10 or less. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 45% of those employing 3 to 9 employees offer health insurance. And so what that means is that 55% of our small businesses are not offering health insurance. We need to provide the flexibility to address this issue, and we are, in most of the circles when we talk about health care these days, we are actually talking about going towards more health care, not less, universal health care versus what we have right now. And I think that this bill gets us started in that direction. Right now, Representative Moe would like to address the bill.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to review a little bit what brought about this bill in 2005. Many here are very concerned about insuring more Minnesotans. This was an effort to bring more people into the insurance pool, small employers and their employees, many of which, when I'm on the campaign trail, have said, listen, I can't afford to offer my employees insurance. My wife and I own a small business. We would like to be able to afford to offer our employees insurance, but we can't. It's too expensive. We provide some money for them. One of them, in fact, is on Minnesota Care because it's a part-time employee. This was an effort to try to bring those people into the market. How do we do that without impacting how we provide insurance for other people? And we passed this flexible benefit plan, as Representative Beatrix said, in a bipartisan way. I want to remind the committee that this is current law. We already passed this into law. And all we are attempting to do is to require the three insurers in Minnesota, which are monopolistic, really, requiring them to offer the product that is currently required of them to do so in statute. This just sets a number that they would have to provide how much they would have to reduce the cost of a plan offering it to small employers. I think it's a good, reasonable approach, and I think we should ask ourselves, perhaps when they come up to testify, why they haven't offered it to date. I think there's some significant issues there that we would like to see addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may call on Mike Hickey.
Mr. Hickey.
MFID. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Really want to thank Representative Beatrix and Moe for stepping forward. As you know, we're the state's largest business group in terms of entities with 14,000 members. And, I think I've never heard so much concern for small businesses here with the big health care reform we talked about the other night, and I had a chance to visit briefly with you about. But this is a huge thing we could do for small business this year we're discussing a lot of other issues in the big health care reform, and I hope they turn out to be better than worse, but we have a lot of ends to work out on that. This is a bill. This is something we can do this year to really help. Our group is not big on mandates. Anyone who knows anything about us knows we're not. We've been in here urging you not to pass mandates in the past that are put on the backs of small employers and not large businesses who are insured under the federal law. But in this case, we are asking you to do this just out of sheer frustration that 3 years later, Representative Dietrich cited the history. We had a huge bipartisan vote when Representative Wilken and Senator Scheid carried this bill in 05, and I really thought something good would come out of it. At a minimum, we might find out what the mandates cost. You know, we have some members on this committee that are real curious about that and trying to set up a process to analyze them and possibly, you know, put some more analytical reasoning into them before they're passed. But we really were hopeful a significant bill would pass, and we have nothing 3 years later, and that's why we're actually offering up a mandatory offer. We thought about making all insurers required to do this, but we held off on that because so many of the insurers who have just a very small percentage of the market are so uncompetitive, and they're so uncompetitive with their provider reimbursement rates. Really didn't make any sense to ask them to do another thing when it wouldn't be competitive anyways, and the big three would be under them even after that policy was distributed in the market. So that was the rationale on the 10%. Nothing against the big three. Work closely with them on a lot of issues. I guess this is one we're just going to have to agree to disagree on due to the sheer frustration. What we're hoping we're going to get out of this bill is badly needed cost savings for small employers. Many analysts have put a 10 to 15% number on the mandates in general, and also flexibility, importantly, for small employers to pick and choose which products you need and which products you don't. Right now, you have to take all 64 of them. And the other thing this bill will do is really uneven, really a level of great inequity we have with those self-insured under the ERISA market. They're exempt from everything that happens in this building. And by the way, they don't pay about 2 to 4% in provider taxes that your struggling small businesses pay. This is going to even that ground out a little bit, the fact that the small employers would finally have the flexibility that the large employers have, at least in some sense, not on the taxes, but on the mandate end. Finally, I just want to urge you not to get too fixated on a certain coverage or a certain benefit. Maternity is certainly a controversial topic that's in the mix. Currently, there's a federal mandate at 15 lives. So the only people who could consider exempting maternity currently under this law in this state is somebody with less than that. In reality, probably only somebody with a couple of employees could exempt maternity, but we had Assurance Company come forward in 1999 and say that mandate alone cost 9% of total premium. Talked to another insurer recently this year, and they said maternity, mental health, and chemical dependency, three very important mandates, but also ones that people would appreciate flexibility on, account for at least 10% of total premium. So the flexibility would really be huge for small employers, and I just urge you to not get too fixated on a certain benefit, because you got to realize, Representative Dietrich cited the number from the Kaiser Foundation, under five, that number would be huge. The uninsured rate for companies under five has got to be in the 60, 70, 80% range. Most people don't have coverage for a huge health calamity if it occurs tomorrow, unless they've been able to get it through a spouse or go purchase it themselves in an individual market. So those people don't have coverage for a huge calamity, a common one that happens to people, and I just hope we don't get too fixated on benefits that are really, you know, intended for certain situations, and I appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I now may call on Tom Snell from Metro North Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Thank you, Chairman of the committee, or chairperson of the committee, and thank you, committee members. The Metro North Chamber of Commerce represents the area in Anoka County. We have approximately 800 business members, and 65% of those business members have five or less employees, most of whom do not offer health insurance coverage because of the escalating costs that health insurance coverage, which we have now. Back in 05, when this bill passed, we were really excited that we were going to be able to see some flexibility in offerings to that small micro business market. And unfortunately, to date, we have not seen from the big three companies that sell coverage in Minnesota an opportunity to offer this type of a flexible benefit to small employers, where there would be a design where a lot of the mandates would be removed. And as you know, companies that are self-insured do not have to offer the mandates that the smaller employer is encumbered to have. And I would really urge you to take a very serious look at this and to move forward so that the companies that the big three would have an opportunity now to really offer a flexible series of benefits by having this mandate, so that we could offer coverage to the small business employer, hopefully at a more reasonable cost. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe would like to make a closing comment, and then he needs to go to another event.
Feel free. Thank you,
Representative Dietrich. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to go represent our caucus or something, so I need to go. I just wanted to thank you for hearing the bill and just ask the committee to allow small businesses to have this tool. It's something we already have passed. It's current law. It will allow more people to get insurance that currently can't afford it. So, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Coleman. Mr. Barton, welcome.
Thank you.
And can I just say, Resident Dietrich, is the 8-2 year amendment?
We haven't offered it yet, but it's...
But that's coming... Okay. I just wanted to clarify where it was coming from. Thank you.
It's in people's packets, I believe.
We have it, yes.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Coleman.
And I only raised that just... Have you guys seen the 8-2 amendment? If you could just address that as well.
Again, my name is Jeanette Coleman. I'm representing Medica today. And I want to start out my comments by saying that we absolutely understand the difficulty that small employers are having. Our salespeople are talking with these individuals every day about the struggles to make health care affordable. And I will comment on some of the things that we are doing to try to help that. So it's not the goal of House File 3721 we oppose, but rather the approach. So as drafted, this legislation would require health plans to create products that have premium reductions of 5% and 10%. According to the legislation, this can only be achieved through a reduction of mandated benefits. In order to achieve a premium reduction of 5% or 10%, plans would be forced to create products that do not include maternity benefits or mental health benefits. This would not be an option for employers with more than 15 employees because federal law requires maternity benefits to be offered to groups of this size. There's also a good chance that Congress is going to be very shortly passing mental health parity legislation. This has been legislation that this country has been waiting for a long time. Minnesota has had it. But if that were to pass, that could also create another difficulty of making this legislation even plausible. So if you look at employers over 15, and I think Mike Hickey just talked about mental or maternity being 9% of the cost of mandates, with total mandates costing 10 and 13%, you can't reach these numbers unless you take maternity out of it. I'd also like to highlight that low-cost products are already mandated in Minnesota. In 1992, the Minnesota legislature passed a law requiring all health plans in the small group market to offer two products referred to as the small employer mandated plans. This was passed at the same time that Minnesota Care was. One is the copay product and one is the high deductible product. The copay product is priced at 20% less than a typical copay product, and the high deductible product is priced at 60% below a typical product. The law specifies exactly what services are to be included in these. Because these low-cost products are already available in the market, this legislation doesn't seem to provide any added benefits than what's already added. I would just like to close by saying that, as I started out commenting on, we understand this is a tremendous problem with the affordability of health insurance. And as this committee has heard, health insurance is expensive because health care is expensive. I want to bring to your attention something that you have in your packet here. It's a flyer on a product that Medica has created called Medica Focus. This product is priced at 20% below a typical plan. It achieves this not by removing important benefits such as maternity and mental health, but by focusing on prevention through the use of home clinics and designing a network of providers that have a proven track record for practicing medicine in a cost-efficient manner. This is very consistent with the ideas put forth by reform legislation, health care reform legislation working through this body. We know that small employers as well as individuals and large employers are struggling to afford health insurance. Removing important benefits is not the approach we should be taking to make health care more affordable. Rather, we need to focus on prevention, health care homes, and changing economic incentives in the health care system to pay for quality and outcomes, not value. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Mr. Burch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Health Partners. As Ms. Coleman said, we certainly appreciate the struggle that small employers are having in offering affordable benefits to their employees, and I appreciate Representative Dietrich trying to do something about this issue. I appreciate her taking the time to meet with us this morning on this. The bill got scheduled late, so thank you for taking the time. I do want to state, however, that we have some real serious concerns with this legislation. Ms. Coleman touched on some of them, but let me just say, you know, we're concerned that this not only won't work, but isn't really needed. We're not sure it can work, and more importantly, it seems pretty inconsistent with the direction that this body and this committee has taken over the last couple of years. First thing I want to take issue with is the assumption that, one, we're not working with small employers to offer affordable benefits and that we're not listening to their needs. We work every day with Mr. Hickey's members to try and offer affordable benefits to his employees. I know Mr. Hickey wants to offer these types of products, but that is not the message that we're getting when we work with his employers. His employers are interested in working with us on flexible benefit designs, things that Ms. Coleman mentioned, that continue to offer a full range of benefits but at a lower cost. Health Partners, in fact, takes advantage of this existing legislation. Some of our most popular products in the small group market use this flexibility to offer products to our HMO that have more cost sharing on the back end, but also allow us to offer more office visits up front with no cost sharing. These are really attractive options for small employers. They're not looking for a reduction in the benefits that are offered. And I actually take a little bit of exception to people who are suggesting we are not concerned about what small employers are doing or not working with them to offer affordable benefits. We've been doing this consistently. We're the ones that are up here fighting for small employers. I have a real serious issue with that. Secondly, as Ms. Coleman mentioned, I'm not sure that this is really plausible. The numbers that are outlined in here that are targets for savings, as she mentioned, aren't reachable unless you start talking about two of the most specific mandated benefits that have a real cost impact, maternity and mental health. We priced them out about 3% each, which means there's some more room to do as well. She also mentioned the issue with maternity benefits for employers below 15 and above 15. I'm not even sure the Commerce Department would allow us to offer different benefit sets to small groups with fewer than 15 employees and above 15 employees. In fact, we're required to offer the same benefit sets to all of them. I don't know if we can even reach these numbers. So I'm not quite even sure if this is plausible. Finally, again, this is pretty inconsistent with the way that this body has been moving in terms of health care reform. This is a mandate. Mr. Hickey said it. And, you know, the term irony gets misused a lot, but the intent of this is to offer relief for mandates, but the impact is going to be an additional mandate that will add the cost of producing this, but it won't relieve any mandate or it won't reduce cost. And I'm not an English major, so if that wasn't the correct definition of irony, someone can correct me, but I think that's pretty close. Secondly, this committee approved 7 mandated benefits last year. You guys passed 7 new ones out of this committee last year. And so, if this is the direction this committee wants to go, please tell me which one of those you don't want us to cover. In fact, we can go through the list that are on the book, and I would rather have Mr. Hickey of this committee tell us which ones we don't want to offer to small employers. Because the way this is written, you're putting the onus on us. And people are going to come back here again and argue that we're not offering them good benefits, and you're going to change the law again. So if that's the direction we want to go, spell out for us what you don't want us to offer and move forward. In addition to the 7 mandated benefits, there are also 2 expansion and benefits of providers that have to be in our network that were passed last year. And just a couple weeks ago, this committee approved the authorization for a 4% tax on insurance premiums, which goes in the opposite direction of what this is doing. And so I don't think this committee wants to send a message that, well, we want to spend money, we want employers to spend money on taxes, but we want them to reduce benefits. I don't think that's where we want to go. If you're looking for answers on how to help us, first thing is stop it. I'm serious, stop it. This is another mandate. Okay, we're going to have to go through the expense of putting these things together, and as I mentioned, no one's out there trying to buy them. Stop it. Second, there's a lot of reform that's moving through the legislature that we think has some real potential benefit. And so I appreciate the work that all of you have been doing on that over the summer and during the beginning of this legislative session. We want to encourage you to continue to do that, particularly in the areas of payment reform, public health. Those are things that are going to have a long-term impact on reducing the overall cost for not just small employers, but for large employers and for all of us. And secondly, if you're looking for some immediate relief for small employers, because they are getting pinned. As Mr. Hickey mentioned, they have to follow all the rules that comply with the state legislature. Self-insured employers don't. One of the biggest examples of this is the EMS assessment. Okay? It's a community, it's the way we fund our high-risk pool that's the benefit to the entire state, but the burden of that falls disproportionately on small employers and individuals. There are ways to help relieve some of that pressure immediately, which will have an immediate next year impact for all small employers, not just those that are trying to make a tough decision as this would require. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I think Ms. Coleman and I would be happy to answer any questions here. And again, I get a little heated up about this because I've been working with Mr. Hickey on this for a couple of years. I understand he's trying to do what he believes is in the best interest of his employers, and I appreciate that effort. I want to work with him on that. And again, I appreciate Representative Dietrich trying to tackle this issue and looking for solutions for her employers as well. Thank you very much.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sitting here smiling because I think it's very ironic, too. And one thing that I think is really ironic, I seem to remember that when this legislation was passed that I was against it. And a lot of people thought that was just terrible, that I should be for it. But, you know, part of the pitch for this, and I have to remember, I don't remember whose pitch it was. Maybe it wasn't yours, but, you know, there was a lot of gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands over how expensive our mandates are, you know. And a lot of these mandates, okay, they're being mandated, but a lot of it is stuff that everybody wants to cover anyway, and that obviously in any decent policy is covered anyway. So I do find this very ironic, and frankly, I don't know which way to go on this, because now that it's here, I kind of think, well, you know, why not see if those small employers can get the benefit of it? But I guess I want to... I have a couple concerns that I'd like to see if you can address. And one of them is it strikes me that if these policies were actually offered, that say for example, leaving out mental health benefits, that this might have some impact on people who are now eligible for Minnesota Care. And under the Minnesota Care policy, can get some of these benefits, and then if small employers are going to offer, say, a policy, if you say you put together a product that had no maternity, no, you know, take out some of these big things, offer that policy, then are those employees now not eligible for Minnesota Care, and suddenly they don't have access to those coverages, period. I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but I'm kind of wondering if that would be one of the results. Then I also have another question, which is what, other than the IMSA assessment and all that stuff that we know that the self-insured don't have to offer, are there particular benefits that they tend not to offer? I mean, aren't they offering maternity benefits? Aren't they offering mental health benefits as a rule? Either of you, whoever wants to try those things.
We'll split it up. Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, to your first question, if this was assumed to offer affordable products that didn't cover maternity or mental health, and that would attract employers who currently don't offer coverage to their employees, it would eliminate the ability of those employees to be eligible for Minnesota Care. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Again, I don't know that anyone would actually purchase these, but if they were to do, it would eliminate any eligibility that those employees had for Minnesota Care, because they'd be eligible for employer coverage.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and just on the second part, you know, it is true that whenever this body passes a mandate, that mandate only applies to a very small and shrinking section of the market. We in the state have created a lot of incentives to become self-funded, whether it be tax or whether it be benefits. For the most part, I will say that the large self-funded groups in this state are very good employers and, for the most part, do accept the benefits. But we have seen areas where that has flaked off, if you will. The mandate for dependent coverage to 25, we have very few large employers, and even our own state exempted themselves out of that mandate. We also see areas around chemical substance abuse treatment and mental health coverage is another area that we see pretty significant differences in what's offered in the self-funded and in the fully insured. And then some of the areas around where you get into very expensive treatment, they will frame their benefits in a way with more cost sharing than is allowed in the private market. So I want to say that I think overall our large employers are good employers, but there are areas where they do start to chew it off.
Okay, we're going to vote on this in about 7 minutes, though, and there's other people on the list.
Okay, real quickly, I just one other concern then that kind of fits in with the Minnesota Care piece is that some of the people who might be then taking advantage of this would be the ones who actually are giving insurance now, if suddenly there's a cheaper plan available. But anyway, I'm going to leave all that because that kind of more goes to whether this law was wise in the first place, and I'm still undecided about how I'm going to vote on this bill.
Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To any of the testifiers, to the author of the bill, how much does it cost to file a product with the Department of Health? How much is it going to cost the health plans to file this product if they offer, or two products, actually, we're talking about?
Either one of you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, I mean, you have hit on something. It is very expensive to create new products. There's a number of things that have to go into that. The research of this type of a product would have a lot of analytical work that would have to go into it, determine what each thing costs, what each mandate costs, and then to figure out the numbers. There would also be a lot of looking at what would be the adverse selection. So, groups that would have this product 1 year and then the next year hire somebody who wants to have a baby, so they jump over to another product. So all of that. And then the filings with the department. I think the creation of a new product and then the annual filings of that is well into the six figures, and it varies dependent on how complicated the product is.
What happens to somebody, okay, they purchase one of these products and they have a child, they're pregnant. How are they going to cover those costs? Or mental health, for that matter, if they have a mental health issue. If those are not covered under these factors, what happens to these people?
Mr. Chair, a couple of things could happen for those who do. Certainly, if there is no maternity coverage, and so therefore somebody is on the policy and gets pregnant, and so they skimp on their prenatal care, that could end up costing the group quite a bit more if a baby ends up being born prematurely. So that cost would be borne by the group. There's also a question with the human rights laws that exist on the book in Minnesota that currently say more than two employees, the employer is responsible for the cost of maternity. So I think there's a question of would the employer, if they don't offer it in a benefit, would they be responsible for it? There would probably have to be a challenge for that. The other basic issue is it ends up being uncompensated care borne by the provider community in the hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. Back in 1992, as was pointed out, Sierra came into place, the Small Employer Insurance Reform Act, and two products were asked to be offered at that time. This sounds like deja vu all over again in some sense, but what happened with those products? Were they popular? Did small employers access them? And if they did or didn't, why?
The most affected constituency of that, Representative Gottwald, those products were fairly inflexible. They're the exact opposite of this plan. It lays out in statute, and possibly some of our witnesses can tell you specifically what it said. but those plans said you take this or you don't take it. There was no flexibility to it. Exact opposite of what this bill is. They're very inflexible packages. I think what you find with a lot of small business owners, they tend to be in their 40s or 50s or older, and they don't want a very inflexible package that they also have to be covered under. But for whatever reason, these plans have yielded almost nothing, but they were very inflexible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to add to that and just say that we all need to remember that this is an option, and it is to give small businesses cost savings and flexibility. I don't think a small business owner with a female age 25 would opt into one of these policies. I don't think that would meet their needs, and I think that their only desire is to provide a benefit to their employees and to add value to what they are doing and to remain competitive with other big businesses that can allow that have much better health care plans. So the word flexibility just comes back once again. This is just meant to give flexibility. It is meant to help insure more people than less. And with all the concerns that have been brought up today, I can't disagree with any of them. But I have to say that having more people insured is better than having less. And some insurance is better than none.
Mr. Chair, for me.
No, I think we got to move on. I'm sorry. Representative Bunn.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue, I want to ask this issue of whether no one's asking for these products or would ask for them. I'd like to see if Mr. Hickey could respond on that. I mean, it seems like there's disagreement on that point, and that seems an important point. So, about whether there's actually demand for these products or not.
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative.
Yes, I would just like to speak to that first because that it was about 3 months ago when Representative Atkins, Representative Moe, and myself, and Mike Hickey, and the three insurance companies got together, and we were going to try to sit down and talk about the issue and what we could do, and I've been thinking about this ever since, and what it really appears to me is that we have never asked anybody to market them. And I think we all know the power of marketing in our society. And unless a product is developed and then it is marketed and gone out and at least given the positives and the negatives, and that this law would make it, this bill would make you lay out both, nobody's going to buy anything. You have to be behind it, and you have to paint it in at least a positive light of something that might be flexible enough to meet your needs, as opposed to offering no insurance for your employees, that this might be your second best option.
I think to that point, I think that is the issue here. I think the concern is that these are plans that can't be made. You can't save 10% if you're not going to exclude maternity, and we're not sure we can do that. We can't discriminate between 15 above and 15 below. I'm going to move the DE1 amendment at this point, which would basically get to exactly the point that Representative Dietrich is making, which is that we got to push to small employers, I think, more aggressively the availability of the plan, the small employer flexible benefit plans. And I think the DE1 does that with a little bit more flexibility, because it's not putting the cost, the 5 and 10% in the in there. And so I think that is I think it kind of accomplishes the goal that Representative Dietrich is trying to accomplish, but in a way that actually may be more workable. Is there a discussion to the DE1 amendment, members? Representative Bunn.
So, I'm not comparing side by side. So are you saying this takes out the percentage?
Yes.
Because you're, okay.
It's the least of the bill.
It's the entire, it's lead all, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Hickey, do you want? Basically, what the amendment does is says that before people, at the time small employers are going to be making their decision about plans, the plans actually have to alert them to the fact that these small employer, that there's the possibility of, well, not that these particular plans are going to be offered, but that there are small employer products available in the market. Including, you know, this Medica focus plan and other plans like that, and make sure that people make sure that the plans are reaching out and saying that there are these products available. Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, my concern with all of this is we're getting two different stories. We've got small employers crying out for price cuts, cost cuts, so that they can actually afford to provide coverage. We've got the health plan saying if they buy this, we'd offer it. It's a market issue. We've got Mike Hickey and the NFIB here basically saying that it's not available to them, that they're not getting that help from the plans. Now we're telling the plans how they have to market it and that they have to market it and what they have to market. And, you know, this is all basically trying to regulate the market, to tell the market what it's supposed to do in response to its own consumers. And again, if I thought for a minute, and Representative Huntley and I have talked about this before, I mean, are employees actually going to buy this? Are we going to go through all these hoops and come back 2 or 3 or 4 or 10 years from now and say, we didn't do anything for small employers at all, we just added additional costs? I have a concern about that. This amendment, the DE1 amendment, is going to add costs, clearly. I mean, if we're going to dictate certain actions on the part of the health plans, it's another mandate on top of a mandate.
Further discussion to the amendment? Seeing that all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The amendment prevails. Further discussion to the bill number. Representative Laffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just to the witnesses here and to Representative Dietrich. I think it has to be acknowledged that in other bills, and you don't serve on this committee, that we've heard, and that Representative Huntley is chairing our main health care reform bill. This is actually cost containment and lowering the cost of insurance was a major focus of it, along with some insurance reform. And it's my hope that that's going to be the route to answering the problems that you've pointed out, because if we're able to reduce the cost, it sounds like that's the only reason for these plans, is to make them affordable. And I think there's a variety of ways to address that, and I'm hopeful that when we implement our health reform package, that we'll see the kind of prices and options in the market that Mr. Hickey's members are looking forward to. And I think there's a variety of different ways to get to a price point, and I think the more thoughtful way is the way this committee's considered it before.
Any further discussion, members? Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Dietrich, do you want to?
Yes, the delete everything, does that delete the whole small employer flexible benefits plan?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Just the new language, yeah.
Today's bill.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Is it drafted that way?
Yes.
Okay.
It just deletes the new language. That's what the delete everything would do.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of Representative Rood will renew her motion that House Bill 3721 be recommended passed and be referred to Commerce as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? No.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you. Resident Hosh, let's go to your bill. Well, I mean, that's right. Resident Hosh, we're obviously pressed for time here, so Representative Hosh, I will move that House File 3649 be recommended to pass and refer up to the floor. Refer to the General Register. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to try to make this a little easier and take up the next four bills on the agenda with the DE1 amendment, the H3648 DE1 amendment, and incorporate the four bills offered by myself and Representative Frick.
Hang on.
Over. What's the delete? The DE1 amendment.
DE1.
Yes.
Oh, we're on the 3649 right now. With the process. I'm sorry. Is that...
Okay, well, Mr. Chair...
Is that going to be an amendment to 3648?
Yeah, 3649 okay. Is included in the DE1 amendment, so if we could deal with 3648, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So to put the bill in the order that the author would like it to... I will move the DE1 amendment on 3648. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All right. All opposed?
I have not read.
So we're on the 83648DE1.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for the confusion. We will have to deal with 3649, but we'll continue on the path where we are now, where it incorporates all the remaining bills. With me, I have staff from the Minnesota Department of Health. Instead of me explaining it due to time reasons, I will just pass on the explanation in which you all have handouts provided to.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Darcy Miner, and I am the Division Director for Compliance Monitoring at the Department of Health. And to go through these very quickly, there are three Department of Health bills in here. The first one, the Notice of Resident Reimbursement Classification. Currently under the case mix system, nursing facilities have an option to either have the case mix classifications mailed to them by U.S. mail or sent to them electronically, and this would require all of them to be sent electronically.
And all of them have capacity to take that?
Excuse me?
All of them have capacity to take it electronically?
Yes, we're told that they do. We've worked with the two provider associations on this. Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And the next section is where the exceptions to the moratorium review, which originally was House File 3648. There are several changes in here. The major one is, and we have worked with the provider associations on this as well, to come up with some changing in the timing for the exceptions process. Currently, there are, the health department has to publish an RFP, and facilities that want to come in under the moratorium exception have to get their proposal in within 90 days. We are asking that that be extended to 150 days, and the reason for that is because some of the proposals have not had enough time to be put together thoughtfully. The facilities still need to get community support. In some cases, they have to get financial support. And they run out of time to try and get something in within 90 days. So by extending that to 150 days, it gives them time. What we also have done in here then is to say that currently we do have the requirement in law that the facilities must start construction within 18 months of approval. And we ask that they let the health department know if there are any issues at 18 months and then ask them to push that back to 15 months. So that there's still time within the 18 months that they can resolve whatever the issues are and still begin construction. We're hoping that because of the extra time on the front end that that would not pose a problem for any of the facilities. There are a number of minor changes in here. We changed the definitions of some of the construction in order to clarify what can be allowed and what won't be allowed. We've modified a couple of changes based on engineering recommendations. And certainly, if there are any questions with them, I'd be glad to go through them more specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, related to the moratorium, is it a moratorium on construction? Is it a moratorium specifically on beds? Can you just give me a little background on the specific language around the moratorium itself?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I will do my best to give a very quick history of it, and I think that perhaps Mr. Feld, who's here from DHS, might be able to give you more if you wanted it. My understanding is that it's a moratorium on beds, but there's also the moratorium then on new construction, and so the legislature authorizes or appropriates money which can be used for the Medicaid reimbursement to facilities for any increase that they may have that they would amortize over time. Have I thoroughly muddied the waters here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll frame the question a little bit differently. I appreciate that. What I was trying to get at is that it seems like this is excessive bureaucracy for the homes as they try to renovate and provide an environment that is suitable for the folks that they wish to serve. So my question was really trying to get at,
if the moratorium is on beds, why then do we require them to come and bring a proposal to the department if they're not changing the number of beds, but just changing the structure of their facility, to upgrading their facility, putting a roof on, putting windows in, whatever that is? Why then do they have to come forward with this big plan, is what I'm trying to get at, if the number of beds doesn't change?
Mr. Chairman and Representatives, the reason for that is because this allows them to actually capture higher rates to reimburse them for the cost of the construction. And as I said, it's spread out over time, and that's why we maintain a pretty close watch on it, because we work with the Department of Human Services to determine what the additional cost to the Medicaid rate will be. Yeah. And so if their construction project is under a certain threshold, they don't have to bring it through the moratorium exception process. It's only when it exceeds a certain threshold that they do have to bring it through this process.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just have one follow-up question. Thank you, I appreciate that explanation. I'm just curious then, as these facilities bring their proposals forward, are all of them approved? Meaning, do you discard any because there isn't the funds, or is it pretty well, once they bring it through the process, it's just a matter of time before they're approved for their increased rates?
Mr. Chair and Representative, actually this past December, I guess, was the first time that I'm aware of that there was adequate funding in the appropriation to fully approve all of the projects that had come in. Nevertheless, we did convene the committee as required by law, and we evaluated each of the proposals, and we had agreed that we would not necessarily approve them just because the money was there. They still had to meet all of the criteria that's in law.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I have one more follow-up.
Representative Ross.
I appreciate it. I'm actually learning along the way here. Do you then, just assume the dollars aren't fully there, do you approve them on do you have a structure set up to approve them on a case-by-case basis, or is it a first-come, first-serve? How do you then decide?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there is a structure set up in law, and so we do convene a committee that includes representatives from providers, from several departments, based on the criteria that's set out in law and that is also reflected in the RFP that's issued by the Department of Health, we evaluate them all at a set time. So as I said before, current law requires that they turn in their proposals within 90 days. After that time, we schedule a day, and they're each allowed to come in and do a verbal presentation about their project. But it's all done at the same time, and we make the decisions all at one time. So it's not first come, first serve. It's done on a competitive basis.
We're out of time here. So.
Okay. Just quickly, is this expanding the nursing home moratorium to board and care homes? I see on line 3.6 that certified board and care is added, and I didn't realize that they were under our existing moratorium.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, actually they already are included in it, and this just is put into the law to make that very clear, but it also is very clear that they are certified only because they are the ones that receive federal rate reimbursement.
Okay, and the last question was on 7.10, where we're taking away the criteria that says the distribution of beds should be targeted towards the actual need, projected need in the year 2020, because we have had problems with sort of the distribution of beds being over-clustered in areas that are not necessarily the growth areas in the future.
Representative Hodge. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, if you look at line 7.2 and 7.3, having to use the data in reference to Section 144A, that pretty much takes the place of the deleted language. So we still have to make sure that the beds are apportioned proportionally for what the needs of the state are.
And with the long-term look.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy is going to move the LA-AO4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Earlier in January, we had a hearing on dementia, where we heard from some of the workers that in certain facilities there may not have been adequate training for some of the workers caring for people with dementia, As a result of that, we've had a series of meetings, I, along with CHAIR providers, the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, Alzheimer's Association, the steelworkers, and the Department of Health, and have reached peace in the valley on the amendment before you, which would change current law in line 1.6, delete the words markets or otherwise promote services, and insert the word serves, and then in lines 1.7 to 1.22, links this language to enforcement and correction orders.
Discussion, members? Does everybody have it? President Hodge?
Mr. Chair, this is acceptable to me and all the stakeholders involved.
Okay. See no discussion. Everybody in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Amendments adopted. Further discussion or questions to the bill members? Okay, seeing none, Representative Ha, I guess I will renew my motion that House File 3648 as amended be passed to the General Register. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. How fast is 3649, do you think? Let's do it. I'll move 3649.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, this is extremely easy. This is removed an outdated reference with our Office of Healthcare Consumer Assistance that no longer exists.
Any discussion, members? All right. Seeing no discussion, all in favor, I will renew my motion that House File 3649 passed to the General Register. Do recommend it passed to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails. We're going to hold over on the last, the 3708, obviously, at this point. So, thank you, Representative Hosh. Thank you, everybody, and we'll see you tomorrow. We are adjourned.